The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to tonight's Free Library of Philadelphia event. My name is Ruth Schaber, and on behalf of my family, I'm thrilled to welcome you to the annual Sandra Schaber Memorial Lecture. As you all know, the Free Library is dedicated to advancing literacy, guiding learning, and inspiring curiosity for all Philadelphians, from the award-winning author event series to groundbreaking learning opportunities offered in the Culinary Literacy Center, the Business Resource and Innovation Center, and there are many other initiatives. These programs and services are made possible only through support from generous individuals like you and me. Please consider making a gift to help the Free Library continue to provide its life-changing resources. My mother, Sandra, had an insatiable curiosity about current events, history, and people. She had many things in common with our speaker tonight. She was an economist, a political pundit wannabe, and a voracious reader of the New York Times. She read it from the front to the back, every article from one page to the next. I don't know how you do that. And I know that if she were with us tonight, she would have knocked us all down to have a chance to pepper our guests with questions. We all wish she were here with us. I'm thrilled, though, to introduce our speaker this evening, Paul Krugman. Called by The Economist the most celebrated economist of his generation, Krugman is the author or editor of more than two dozen books, including The Age of Diminished Expectations, The Conscience of a Liberal, and End This Depression Now, as well as the former monthly columns No Free Lunch in Fortune and The Dismal Science in Slate. A New York Times op-ed columnist since 1999, he won the Nobel Prize in 2008 for his work in international trade and monetary geography. In his latest book, Arguing with Zombies, Krugman tackles common fiscal misunderstandings and offers a guide to the most vital economic policy issues of our time. He'll be joined in conversation by Mark Zandi, chief economist of Moody's Analytics, and my new best friend, because it turns out he knew my mother when she was early in her career. We are so grateful to have him here with us this evening. Please join us in welcoming Paul Krugman and Mark Zandi.
Well, hello. Hi, Ruth. That was a very nice introduction. I didn't connect the dots until we had the reception earlier that I knew Ruth's mom. I was a grad student at Penn, and I needed to make some money. And so I worked at this company, and there was Ruth's mom, Sandra Schaber. She was a force, an icon. And yeah, it's great to meet you. She was a great woman, a pleasure to work with, and I learned a lot from her. And it's an honor and a pleasure to be here with Paul Krugman. Glad you could make it here to Philly.
Delighted to be here.
I want to tell you that I don't know where my wife is, but there she is. She's your biggest fan.
Okay.
She's your biggest fan. Every day I come home, almost every day, and she has cut out your column for me to read.
Okay.
No kidding. I go, do I have to? No, I love reading your column. And I loved your book.
Okay.
It was a fantastic book. So thank you for being here. You ready to dive right in?
Sure.
Okay. So what do you think about this economy? nice open-ended question, but how do you think it's performing?
What
do you
think? I mean, full employment, we're pretty... I think pretty close to full employment, although one of the things that we're finding out is there seems to be more people willing to come into the labor force given the availability of jobs than not. So that's good. It's not you know, what's fueling the economy, what's keeping it going, is that after all of those years of saying deficits are terrible, as soon as Republicans held the White House, trillion-dollar deficits are fine. So we're getting a lot of fiscal stimulus, and it's not well-done fiscal stimulus, but it is giving the economy a kick. You know, it's not great. The growth is at rates that are not spectacular, but employment is high. Distribution is just terrible still. Inequality is not going down in any meaningful way. But look, better than 9% unemployment. So I guess you shouldn't complain about that. But lots of stuff just not being, you know, we should be using this moment to be dealing with our future problems, and we're not. Actually, if I'm going to add that, it's a pretty straightforward estimate. Trump's tax cut and a few other policies have added about $300 billion a year at an annual rate to the deficit, which is almost as big, by the way, as the Obama stimulus at its peak. Imagine what America would look like now if Obama had been allowed to spend $300 billion a year on infrastructure. Just think about all of the money we could have been spending making America better that instead we just gave as essentially unproductive tax cuts to corporations.
Right. So there's a lot to unpack there. And you kind of got to this, but how much, we have a 3.5% unemployment rate.
Yeah.
50-year low. Economy is growing pretty close to its potential.
Yeah.
Creating enough jobs to maintain that low unemployment. How much credit would you give President Trump and his policies for this good economy?
I mean, if you actually ask, one way to look at this is to say, suppose you take a chart of employment or GDP or pretty much anything else that starts in 2010, as the financial crisis was fading away, and you presented any of those charts to somebody who somehow didn't know that there was an election in 2016, would they know that anything happened in 2016? The answer is they wouldn't. There's no break. It's just a straight trend of steady growth that began 10 years ago. So there's been no break in the trend associated with Trump. Now, he did no disaster either, but no break. And the increased budget deficit is definitely providing some stimulus. Anybody could have done that, you know, assuming that you have a Congress that's willing to let you borrow a lot of money and hand it out, you're going to give the economy some boost. So there is something. I wouldn't say exactly it's Trump, but it's the fact that Republicans suddenly decided that deficits are okay. It has helped the economy, but not a lot. I mean, if you try, I can go on, but if you try and do a multiplier on the Trump stimulus, it's less than one. It's a really inefficient. It's not much bang for the buck, but it's a heck of a lot of bucks.
So, what do you think of his trade policy? Do you think that's been? Does that make sense to you? Is that a plus for the economy, a negative for the economy? How do you think about that?
Okay. So again, I got a multiple level here. So trade is my home. You know, I spent
most. I knew that.
Yes, you knew that. But you know what spent most of my first 30 years as an economist doing. My God, how I've been at this a long time. Where did all those years go? But anyway, doing international trade. It's a favorite subject of mine, obviously. But the dirty little secret of international trade is it's less important. Certainly, trade policy is less important than people tend to think it is. People get all hung up on international trade because it sounds important, global. Actually, my parents once gave me a sweatshirt that said global schmobile on it. And I said, why? And they said, well, because you're always going off to some conference and we ask you what it's about, and you say global schmobile. And so people love to talk about trade, but to the extent that we screw up on trade policy, it's nothing. We actually spend about the same share of national income on imports that we spend on healthcare. And healthcare is a horror of horrible policy. Trade policy is not nearly so bad, and so it's really not all that important. Given all of that, what Trump has done is clearly a negative. In fact, it's done more damage than I expected it would, because it turns out that the uncertainty that he's created is doing a lot of damage over and above the direct effects of the tariffs. But it's not a huge thing. We're talking fractions of a percent of GDP. So it's, I actually think that the worst aspect of Trump's trade policy is not really the tariffs, it's the loss of credibility. People now know that America can't be trusted. You know, if you have a regime under which we arbitrarily suddenly slap tariffs on imports of aluminum from Canada in the name of protecting national security, then what good is an American promise on anything?
Right. So you're not a fan of the tariffs, then?
No, I mean, the tariffs are actually, what's impressive is that the tariffs haven't even reduced the trade deficit. We've just—they've raised consumer costs. They've alienated a lot of people. As best we can tell, they've actually probably somewhat reduced the number of manufacturing jobs in the United States through their indirect effects. So, no, I'm not a big fan. I don't think it's a front-rank policy issue, believe it or not. But it is distinctly Trumpian, and it happens to be a bad policy.
Now, the President Trump would respond, look, the Chinese have been eating our lunch, and probably use those words, those exact words, for decades, and we've done nothing about it. Should we do something about it? Is the relationship with China unfair? And if so, how, you know, if you were king for the day, how would you go about addressing that imbalance?
Okay. China has not been a good global citizen. China routinely rips off intellectual property. It doesn't have a lot of tariffs, but it has a lot of hidden or subsidies that distort the trade. And it's not clear that how much damage that does to America as a whole, although it hits particular sectors when it does it. And we really should have some effort to get, especially as the Chinese get richer, they've got to start. You know, you have a middle-income country, which is a huge part of the global economy. They need to play by the rules. But the way to do that is to form an alliance with other countries that are prepared to impose some sanctions on China if it doesn't start playing by the rules. Not to go after the Chinese with kind of arbitrary tariffs, and at the same time be pissing off all of our allies. So this is, and if you actually look at what we have a deal with China. Not clear what the content really is, but so far as we can tell, it mostly looks as if Trump declared victory and surrendered. That none of the core issues did the Chinese give any ground. They've agreed to buy some more soybeans, and that is that ain't worth a hill of beans. It's amazing actually how little all of that drama has bought in terms of a change in Chinese policy.
Now, I go to Democratic events, and I go to Republican events. I'm more D than I'm R, but the R's tolerate me because I'm considered to be a rational D. So I go to some Republican events. And the one thing I hear all the time, and I want to get a reaction to, and it's still on this theme of what, you know, how much credit should the president get for this good economy or this perceived good economy, is regulation. That it's regulatory changes that have been key to this good economy and the economic growth that we've been getting. What do you think of that argument?
Well, first of all, again, the economy, we don't need an extra explanation. The growth is not spectacular, and it's easy to explain given the increased budget deficits. So there's no need to invoke regulation. And if you want to say, well, regulation has had huge costs, and Trump is therefore doing a great thing, there's not a lot of evidence for that. In fact, there's a pretty long track record. Every time we do have some increase in regulation, whether it was acid rain or the ozone hole or various things, the industry always says this will be devastating, it will cost millions of jobs, and then you get a chance to look back a few years later and it turns out that the costs were a tiny fraction of what industry claimed. And of course there are benefits as well. So if we actually look at The Clean Air Act is the biggest thing. And the Clean Air Act of 1990, in particular, did a lot of stuff that really curbed acid rain, did a bunch of stuff. And we can put some value on what it achieved in terms of health issues, you know, air pollution, even leaving climate change aside, just playing the health costs, the mortality and sickness costs of local air pollution. And that act, it turns out the Clean Air Act is a huge net benefit to the economy. And so all of this, when somebody says that regulation is a terrible burden, you really do want to ask who is saying this and what is their stake in it, because the actual historical record doesn't bear that out at all.
You said when I asked you about the economy, how well it was doing, you did bring up the issue of income and wealth equality,
yeah,
or inequality. And that's top of mind here in Philadelphia. Philadelphia has one of the highest poverty rates in the country.
Yeah.
25% of, a little over 25% of the city, the Philadelphia city, the residents are in poverty.
Yeah.
So it's a real significant, a very significant issue here. What do you think are the underlying causes? And poverty is just one aspect of income and wealth inequality. You know, I don't mean to be focused on that explicitly. In your view, what is the underlying broad forces at work that are creating the skewing of the income and wealth distribution that we're experiencing today?
Okay, I'm supposed to be able to answer that because where I actually sit these days, I'm at the City University of New York Graduate Center at the Stone Center for the Study of Socioeconomic Inequality, which is a great group of interdisciplinary. Actually, we actually have sociologists and political scientists. We actually talk to each other, if in academia that is really rare. For those of you who know this, the remarkable thing is that after all these years, we're still not very clear. Used to be we had a simple story that was, it was really all about technology that was increasing the return to skills. But that kind of story has increasingly fallen apart in the face of the evidence. It's just not, it doesn't track what we're seeing. We're seeing people with similar levels of skills, as far as we can tell, having very divergent income. It looks as if a lot of what's happening is has to do with, if I can say, power relations. I mean, if you ask why are so many people earning extremely low wages, it's partly because minimum wages haven't even kept up with consumer prices, let alone average incomes. If you ask why are workers so much worse off in many sectors, it's the decline of unions. So that's not a full explanation, but there seems to be a really strong political, institutional power relations story. I think maybe the more important question is what can you do about it? And let me say one thing that we do know for sure. If you're talking about poverty particularly, there was a huge debate about the causes of poverty. You know, it goes back to now to the 60s. And for a long time, the story was that basically the problem was the poor, that it was cultural factors, that it was that, you know, you had a culture of poverty, as particularly, you know, non-white inner city people, and there was something wrong with them. But you had a pushback from other people, especially the sociologist William Julius Wilson, who said, no, actually, the economics comes first. It's the disappearance of good jobs that causes to the extent that there's a social collapse, it's a consequence of the economics. And if you wanted to test that hypothesis, what would you do? What you would do is you would take a bunch of, if the problem has historically been inner city blacks, you want to say, let's take away all the good jobs for a group of rural white people and see if they experience cultural collapse. And guess what? We've done that experiment and it's happened. And it's really clear that poverty is not because there's some cultural, it's not a cultural story, it's an economic story. It's the disappearance of good jobs, which in turn has a lot to do with power, political relations, and maybe more important, is clearly amenable to policy. There's a lot we could be doing that we're not doing.
So you in your book, you have a whole section on income and wealth inequality. Another section that you devote the book to is on another very significant problem, and that is climate change.
Yeah.
And maybe you can give us a sense of how you're thinking about how serious a problem this is and what should the policy response to that be?
Okay. So actually, as I say in the book, is that there are times when I wonder how I can justify writing about anything else. Because climate change is an existential threat. If we continue on our current course, the climate models have been highly successful, except that in general we tend to track the worst case scenarios. So if you were watching the scenes from Australia, this is the leading edge of what climate change looks like. It's horrific and it's civilization threatening. It really is existential. And the thing that is so infuriating about it is that at this point, the economics of we can't avoid now having, we already had significant climate change. There will be more because there's so much that's kind of in literally already in the atmosphere that will do it. But we could really change the trajectory dramatically at quite low cost because we've had a technological revolution in the energy sector. Renewables were, seemed like a kind of a fantasy 15 years ago. Now, in many cases, they're just plain cheaper than, even without any policy, they're just cheaper. The Trump administration has been trying desperately to find ways to force people to keep burning coal because the market economy doesn't want to burn coal anymore. And so it would take quite modest policies to drastically shift the trajectory, and it's all about the politics. Now, there's an interesting debate where I'm among economists, among people who are serious about this, about what exactly the policies should consist of. And what the Econ 101 story is that what you need to do is you need to put a price on emissions, carbon tax or cap and trade, which effectively creates a tax on carbon emissions, and that should be the centerpiece of policy. And I'm all for that. But I look at, along with a lot of other people, I look at what's happened on the technology front, and where you see that there's really dramatic improvements in technology that didn't just happen. They came about in large part because we did have some policies pushing for clean energy, which led to, I'm trying to avoid economics jargon here, but I can't help saying endogenous. We've gotten so good at solar and wind in the past 10 years because we had financial incentives for solar and wind, which led to people learning how to do it better, going down the learning curve, which suggests that technological promotion, infrastructure investment should also be a big part of it. And of course, carbon taxes is a kind of eat your spinach mm-hmm. policy. It's not tends to be not be popular. We should do it anyway, but if you want to sell it, you probably want to include a lot of positive, obviously, job-creating stuff. So you want to have infrastructure, technology, job creation, and let me coin a phrase here. Let's call it a Green New Deal, right? So I'm a big Green New Deal person because that's something like that. It would be a Christmas tree. Have a little something for everybody. But that's good. That's a plus here. You want to include a lot of a lot of attractive payoffs as well as the eating your spinach.
Yeah, there's a proposal for a carbon tax dividend. So carbon tax, you get the money.
Yeah,
you dividend it back to everybody. Everyone gets the same size check, whether you're a millionaire or you're a working class American. Interests. What do you think of that idea? A lot of economists, even Republican economists, are for that.
A lot of Republican economists are for it, and a lot of people are. A lot of economists are for it because they think that it will make it politically acceptable. What I would say is, first, that's not the optimal use of the money. I mean, there are so many things we really should be doing if we can get some additional revenue. But if that was what it took to sell it politically, I'm for it. But I actually think that the people who think that that will make it politically acceptable are living in a fantasy world. The Republican opposition to climate policy is not something that you can make go away with a clever financial trick. It's not something it's about the power of fossil fuel interests. It's about just general hostility to science, to any of this, and having a clever scheme where you have a carbon tax that then gets redistributed. I don't think you're going to win over. You might win over some voters, but you probably wouldn't win over a single Republican member of Congress with that kind of scheme. And it is true, there are Republican economists who favor this. You will notice that not one of those Republican economists has a position with the current administration or any significant influence on Congress. There are lots of perfectly reasonable economists who think or thought that they were Republicans, but they actually the GOP doesn't want them. They want the charlatans and cranks, which is not my phrase. It comes from Greg Mankiw, one of those used to be Republican economists who recently declared that he's no longer a Republican on the issue of climate change.
Yeah. Oh, did you say that?
Yeah.
Oh. Okay. I'm going to ask you about a few more controversial policy proposals that are coming out of the Democratic candidates as they run for president. And just get your take on them. I'll give you a chance to take a drink there. You ready? Okay.
This would be improved if we had a table. Anyway, okay.
What do you think about student loan debt forgiveness? So the idea is that you've got $1.6 trillion in student loan debt outstanding, and this is a burden, clearly, on the kids that have the debt. A lot of them are millennials. And the proposal is to forgive the debt. Now, Bernie Sanders would forgive, I think, the bulk of the debt. Senator Warren would forgive half the debt, depending on your income level. But the spirit's the same. What do you think of that idea?
I think it's a reasonable one-time policy. The fact of the matter is that we've had... We've had a really, really dysfunctional higher education setup where with a lot of institutions that are purely ripoff operations. The for-profit education sector is a nightmare of scamming. And in principle, you might say, well, we should only forgive debt that was run up by people who were taken in by the scams, and the debt that was incurred legitimately shouldn't be forgiven. But that's an impossible task. That makes it's the hurdles that people would have to cross would be just too great. So as a one-time answer, but it's a one-time answer. It will take off some of the burden. What's much more important is that we crack down on the scams, so that looking forward, this doesn't happen again. I wouldn't be for full forgiveness, but I would be for some. And people say, well, but won't that mean that some affluent people get, it's not, if it costs more money to try and prevent some person who doesn't need the help from getting help than it does to just give the help, then don't do it. So I'm for it. I don't think it's a big enough problem for enough people that it's worth doing. I suspect, I actually haven't looked at these in detail, and I suspect that just given the people, the Warren plan is probably a lot more carefully thought out. But look, as far
I've looked at it. It is carefully thought out. Yeah, it's carefully thought out. So what about though the kids that follow, right? So I've forgiven all this debt. I still got kids going to school. They still can't afford the tuition. They'll have to borrow. What about those kids?
Yeah, the structural answer there is we used to have a very extensive, proud system of high-quality public education with low tuition. And we've starved that system of funds so that it used to be possible for students to get a good education without going deep into debt, and what we need is to bring that back. We also used to not allow the kind of degree by over the internet and just fork over $10,000, or just generally a very large part basically for-profit education is almost entirely a scam. And so we should be cracking down on all of that. And there are still bits of it, by the way. So I retired from Princeton now 5 years ago. And through
explains why you look so good.
Well, it's it. No, but I took up. Yeah, I have a very, very sweet deal with very limited teaching now at the City University of New York Graduate Center, yeah, which is where the Stone Center sits. But the CUNY system is kind of a remnant of that great public university system that we used to have in much of the country. And it's got 250,000 students, 40% of whom come from families with incomes under $20,000 a year. And tuition is zero or minimal. Most students come out debt-free. And there have been some studies. Raj Chetty has done some studies of which institutions in the U.S. education system actually promote upward social mobility. And a few of the UC systems, schools, and several of the CUNY schools are just off the charts at doing that. So we actually know how to do this. We need to recover the wisdom that we have. I don't think the federal or I don't think the government is obliged to cover the tuition of somebody who goes to Princeton or Yale. And in fact, those schools can do it themselves, which they do for the handful of poor kids they admit. But to have a good public system is a big deal. By the way, it turns out that Janet Gornick, who runs the Stone Center and used to run Luxembourg Income Study, which is where all of your international inequality comparisons come from, and I are both CUNY babies. Her father went to CCNY. Mine went to Brooklyn College. So it's a historic engine of upward social mobility and continuing to play that role. But outside New York City, there's nothing like it.
Okay, another, controversial proposal coming out of the Democratic candidates. And I think this is controversial, is Medicare for all. What do you think of Medicare for all? By the way, let me tell you this. My wife is not a fan.
Okay. Now, the funny thing is...
You may hear from her.
I shall tell you a story. So the book is dedicated to the late Uwe Reinhardt. Yes. Who was a great healthcare economist at Princeton, and the person I turned to, wonderful person, and the person I turned to when I started writing about healthcare, because I didn't do healthcare economics, I'm making sure I wasn't saying anything too stupid. And Uwe, as it turns out, Uwe and his wife, Mei Chung, who's from Taiwan, they actually put together the Taiwanese healthcare system, which is single payer. So Taiwan has a Medicare for all type system, but it was easy to do because there was nothing existing in 1995 when they instituted it, because there really was no insurance system at all. And so they were basically working, able to do a tabula rasa, start from scratch. And if I could start from scratch in America, I would say, sure, let's do single payer. We were able to do Medicare as it exists because in 1965 there were senior citizens basically couldn't get health insurance. Mm-hmm. So you were able to start. Now, the trouble with Medicare for All as a proposal for now is that it's like the old joke. If I wanted to get there, I wouldn't start from here. Mm-hmm. Half the population does have private insurance. They're not wildly unhappy with it. You're proposing to take to tell 160 million Americans, we're going to take away the insurance you rely on and replace with something else. Trust us, it'll be better. And it may well, in fact, be better, but it's a tremendously hard political lift. And I would say that this is not what you should be doing, and it's not the only way to go. Mm-hmm. Every other advanced country has some form of universal health coverage. Some of them do it through single payer. Others do it in other ways. The Netherlands has a system which is based upon regulated and subsidized private insurance, basically like Obamacare done, an adequately funded, adequately regulated version of Obamacare. So the question is, why make this very, very hard political reach right now when we know that there are other ways that are much easier to do that would actually get you to the same place?
I think you get along with my wife.
Okay.
Yeah. One more controversial proposal, and again, maybe it's not, but it is in many circles, the wealth tax. So this is a tax on folks that have lots of wealth, key source of revenue that drives a lot of the numbers for the Warren campaign and for the Sanders campaign. What do you think of that?
I like the idea. I mean, there's a question. There are a couple of reasons for thinking about a wealth tax. One of them is that we do want very high income, high wealth people to pay more taxes, especially given how much inequality has grown. And as it turns out, our tax system has increasingly skewed towards taxing earned income more heavily than unearned income. Not necessarily. Maybe you earned your wealth in some way, or your parents earned your wealth. But the fact of the matter is that the wealth that you get from owning assets, the income you get from owning assets, ends up paying lower taxes than the income you get from actually just working at something. That's a really good reason to be taxing wealth. And by the way, we do tax wealth of certain kinds. We tax real estate. People's houses pay, in effect, a large wealth tax. It's a proposal that, in terms of justice, in terms of going after the right things, is something that has a lot to recommend it. Now, there's a controversy about how effectively can you collect it? How well would wealthy people be able evade it? And the trouble with the historical record there is that most of the wealth taxes that we've seen have been very partial. They've been full of loopholes, and it turns out that if you have a wealth tax that's full of loopholes, one thing wealthy people can do is hire really good accountants, and so they exploit the loopholes, which makes it a pretty bad guide. There's some legitimate dispute among economists about how much revenue a wealth tax can actually raise, but I tend to lean. I'm not just motivated reasoning. I'm persuaded by the people who think it can, in fact, raise a lot of money.
So you wouldn't side with Larry Summers on that?
I'm not. I respect Larry a lot, but I think he's wrong on this one.
He's wrong on this one. Okay, we're going to take questions in just a few minutes. The ground rules there are questions. No speeches. You saw how I asked questions. I got strong views too. But I didn't. You have no idea what I'm thinking. It's about Paul Krugman. So you got that? Okay. We'll come back to you. I want to ask a couple of questions about your work. So how do you do it? You are so prolific. You write a couple columns every week, which, by the way, I write one a month for the Inquirer, and I think that's going to kill me. But you write twice a week for the New York Times and book after book after book. What's the deal?
Okay.
Can I touch you? Can I?
All right. I actually once heard an interview with Isaac Asimov, if people remember.
He wrote
hundreds of books.
Did he really?
Yeah, because he wrote many, many nonfiction books in addition to the science fiction.
Oh, I did not know.
And an interview asked, how do you manage to write so much? And he said, I've thought about this a great deal, and the answer is, I have no idea. there are a few tricks. One is I follow stuff. So I'm always accumulating material. I use one of those link saving things, so I'm always making sure that I have a stock of stuff so that I'm keeping abreast of a number of issues, and then sort of react to the news cycle about which one to write about. And then there are a few things to remember. One is that columns don't all have to be different. Returning to something that you've done before is okay. You want to say something new, but understanding that you have an intelligent, alert, interested readership, but they don't necessarily know things that you may think are obvious. So often pointing out something that you that your professional colleagues think is barely even worth mentioning can be revelatory to the public. And then there's a little bit of style, effort. You always have to have a hook at the beginning to draw people in. You have to have a stinger at the end so that they remember it when they finished. I find it's not actually, once you get into, of course, the other thing is practice. I mean, I started writing columns. I was a columnist for U.S. News and World Report in the 1980s.
No way.
I never met anybody who read it. And I was terrible. And so part of the answer is, how did I get to Carnegie Hall? The answer is practice.
Yeah. Those 10,000,
Yeah.
So is there any one or series of pieces you wrote that you are most proud of? I mean, you were telling me 23,000, did you say that?
No, 2,000.
2,000, sorry.
I've written more than 2,000 columns for the Times. The period, there are two periods, more than that. This is going to turn into a Monty Python routine. Amongst the periods, I was very proud of the writing I did on healthcare. There was kind of a coalition of progressive nerds who were who looked after we'd managed to beat back Social Security privatization, who said, "What can we do? What's a positive thing?" and began the campaign that eventually led to Obamacare, which for all its flaws has gotten 20 million people health insurance. So I'm proud of that work. Probably the most, in a peculiar kind of sick way, the most fun I've had was in the 5 or so years after the financial crisis, when there was a perfect convergence between my academic work, because I'd actually written quite a lot on exactly the kinds of problems the world was having after 2008, and my writing for the Times. And it was a period when I felt like I could actually try to educate people a little bit on what does policy have to do? What are bad ideas? What are good ideas? And that was came up with. I still think in some ways my enduring contribution to economics discourse may be some of the insults I came up with during that period. So talking about people who believe in the confidence fairy that will rescue you from the consequences of spending cuts, That's it's always you're in the moment, and it's very few times that I guess the things I value the most are the times when it seems as if maybe I helped make a difference, which was the case on Social Security, was the case on healthcare. I will say that only once in my life have I actually talked to a person in power, told him what he should do, and have him actually do it. And unfortunately, that person was the Prime Minister of Japan, so it wasn't. It's never worked here.
By the way, these topics you just brought up, Social Security, Obamacare, and all the things we have been talking about, are exactly what the book's about.
Right. The book is a collection, but it's not a random collection.
Yeah.
It's thematic and with introductory material to put it all in context.
Right. Exactly. Good. Okay. We're going to turn it to the audience.
So what are your comments on Andrew Yang's universal basic income?
That's something I would like to like. But there are two problems. There are two problems with Yang. First of all, his diagnosis of what ails us is that it's technology is taking away all the jobs. And there's just no sign of that in the data. If you actually look, if that were true, productivity should be soaring. In fact, we have very sluggish productivity growth. So we have lots of fancy tech gadgets, but it's not. The broader measures don't suggest that that's actually the problem that we face, and that the real issues are very different. And the second thing about UBI, universal basic income, is that if you give everybody an income, no questions asked, then you either the income is way inadequate, or it's incredibly expensive. And so a UBI answer to our problems is either going to require unrealistic, I think politically unrealistic levels of taxation to support it, or is going to be not enough to live on, which is why I think we do need to, for the time being, at least stay focused on more targeted, means-tested anti-poverty programs. I would love to if the answer was as simple as what Yang is saying, but I don't think it is.
What policy would you recommend to bring, like, jobs and capital investment back to the United States with our multinational corporations?
Oh, okay. So the jobs is not a problem, actually. I mean, the quality of the jobs, the wages is a problem, but we actually are, you know, we're doing pretty well at generating jobs. And the truth is, capital... we have not had a lot of capital flee the United States. If you take the broad measures, they say that the United States has been a net recipient of inflows of capital for decades. What you're probably thinking about is that corporations have moved a lot of money outside the United States, except, you know, they haven't really. What they've done is they've cooked the books so that they appear to have a lot of money outside the United States. But that's just an accounting entry. It's not inhibiting their ability to invest in America at all. My best phrase of recent years: Ireland is a big tax haven, no corporate tax, and so companies like Apple, you know, cook the books basically so that their profits all appear in Ireland, which makes it look as if they have enormous assets in Ireland, but it's just fictitious, and that does weird things to Irish national statistics. So there was one year where, according to their official statistics, the economy grew 23%. And it didn't actually happen, and on the spot I called it leprechaun economics. Yeah. And luckily the Irish have got a good sense of humor. They actually liked it.
Yes, sir.
If you were the mayor of Philadelphia, what are the three programs you would recommend to reduce poverty?
Oh, wow. So I don't know Philadelphia at all. Let me tell you.
It's a great American city.
Yes. I'm not sure, but I can talk about New York, and let me say that...
No, don't do that.
No, but it, but it's relevant, I think, because it is a model. It's a big city with considerable autonomy. It's bigger than many national governments, right? And we have a mayor who rubs lots of people the wrong way, but has actually done some very good things. And he's done two policies in particular that have made a significant difference. One of them is universal free pre-K. Mm-hmm. And
I hear too, Mayor Kenney. Yeah.
So absolutely, and programs like that, but that particularly. So, I would extend that to just as close as you can get to universal child care. Mm-hmm. That's something that really should be done at the national level, but cities can do a lot of it. And then de Blasio in New York has tried to build more affordable housing. Yeah. And he's actually done it. I think we're talking about around 200,000 units. The trouble is New York is so big that is only making a small dent in the problem. But those are housing and children are the places where a city government can make a big difference. To some extent, you have to live within a national environment. You can't change everything. But those are places where you really can make a difference.
Real quick, rent control.
Okay.
Oh, no, it wasn't going to be quick. Sorry.
Not going to be quick. No, I mean, on the whole, people have been saying, we've rethought some things, like minimum wages, the economics look very different from what we thought they did. But I still think rent control, in the end, constrains the housing supply. You don't want to do abrupt decontrol, but it's probably not, has not been helpful. And I'm enough of an orthodox economist to not favor that.
Yes, sir.
Hi. As one of your big followers, I've been looking forward to seeing who you would endorse for president among the Democrats.
Okay.
And could you just tell us in confidence?
Right. So, all right. So I am actually specifically forbidden
to endorse candidates by the New York Times. And the reason they do that is because they've had incidents where somebody writes an opinion piece, and then people say, the New York Times says vote for Joe Smith, and when it was just some columnist. You know, in principle, you don't know which party I favor, right? But let me give you my take. I actually don't think, in terms of policy, it's going to matter very much. Whoever the Democrats nominate, assuming that he or she wins, the actual policy is going to be moderately progressive. If Bernie Sanders becomes president, he's going to come in with $60 trillion of spending plans. Very little of that's going to happen. He's going to end up with enhanced Obamacare and probably a wealth tax. If Joe Biden becomes president, he may have had some fairly conservative centrist views in the past, but the Democratic Party has changed, he's changed, and what he's going to end up with is enhanced Obamacare and probably a wealth tax. So I think the reality is, if you're a Bernie or a bust person or a never Bernie person, think again, because it really is going to be what we're going to get if the Democrats win is we're going to get a significantly left of center, but not hugely left of center set of policies. The individual is really not that important.
Thank you.
Good answer. I think he could run for president. What do you think with that answer? That was pretty good.
I wanted to ask about the Fed. Have you talk a little bit about how their tools are being reduced or maybe just changing, and this bumping off of a zero interest rates, and also like now just like tinkering with repos all the time, and just what is the Fed doing these days?
Okay, that might be a little too wonky for some people, but look, we used to have a tremendous faith in the ability of the Fed to stabilize the economy. It was always a theoretical possibility that you might cut interest rates to zero and that wouldn't be low enough. And then it becomes really hard. And it turns out to be not a theoretical possibility. I mean, some of us were alerted to the reality of the possibility back in the 90s looking at Japan. There was actually a crew of sort of Japan warriors that included me and this, what was the guy? I used to know him, Ben Bernanke, forgotten what, I don't know what he did later on. And everything that you've seen since has been fairly desperate efforts to get some traction in the face of a situation in which even zero interest rates are not low enough. There are legitimate and very hard to resolve disputes about how effective these measures are. I'm kind of a skeptic. Bernanke has much more faith that they actually really matter than I do. But they don't do a whole lot of harm. At worst, they're ineffectual. But fundamentally, what it's come down to is that for whatever the reason, we seem to be an economy where situations where you hit the zero lower bound, where zero interest rates are not low enough to assure full employment, instead of being a rare black swan event, is kind of almost the norm for the economy. And I just think that we're asking too much to expect the Fed to solve that. This is where we need other policies, and it would be a great economy in which to spend a lot of money on infrastructure. Mm-hmm.
What's your take on fossil fuel divestiture, both in terms of its impact on the fossil fuel industry and potential impact on climate change?
I'm unclear how much impact the investment strategies have here, although maybe. I mean, we really should be... Greta Thunberg is totally right. Nobody should be investing in fossil fuels at all. And certainly the ethical thing for investors would be not to invest in it at all and not to be part of that Basically, the fossil fuel industry right now is actually a zombie of a different kind. The zombies in the title of my book are zombie ideas that won't go away. But the fossil fuels is basically a zombie industry. It should be dying, and it's kept going largely through the political power of the special interests. And so we should get out of it. Now, whether divestiture by institutional investors is going to force that to happen, I have my doubts. I think in the end, we are going to need a lot more in the way of government policy to make it happen. But surely you don't want to be one of those people who has a stake in continuing to destroy civilization.
I'm not a believer in the wealth tax. I make my choices based on where I think the country, the economy, is going to get the best return. Let's say I have $100,000. I can put it into the black hole of more tax and fund what's going on today in the Congress and the Senate.
All right.
Or I can put that money towards good companies in the U.S. that are going to grow and create jobs. What's your opinion of that?
I think that is all based upon a complete myth about where your tax dollars go. I mean, it's one of those things that people believe that the U.S. government wastes vast amounts of money. You should look at what is that? What is the federal budget actually? What does the U.S. government do? And the summary actually is one of these things. I keep on searching for the original of this, and it always comes back. It ends up that people attribute it to me, but it isn't. I stole it from somebody, but I don't know who. That the U.S. government is basically a giant insurance company with an army. That if you actually ask where the money goes, it's Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and national defense. The amount of waste, there aren't that many employees at the federal level, and particularly if you take out the post office, which is, by the way, a great institution, unfairly maligned. And the rest of it is going to give people some decency in their retirement, give people health care. Is that such a terrible thing? Is that a waste of money as compared with, particularly with these days where corporations are simply using a lot of their profits to buy back stock? I mean, is that it's just this myth about what government is and what it does. It's not true by the numbers. It's not true by personal experience. If you look at what the lives of most people would be like if we didn't have the government programs we have, they would be nastier, a lot more brutish, and a lot shorter.
I actually have two questions I hope he can answer.
Oh dear.
Now, are these good questions?
These are good endings.
All right.
One.
All right.
One is economically, what keeps you up at night?
That's a good one.
What do you worry about? And specifically, do you worry about the deficits that seem to be going on forever? And the second question I have is about Medicare for All. In Medicare for All, we currently have a system, a dual system, that includes government Medicare, but also Medicare Advantage, which allows people to keep or buy health insurance privately. Is that a system? Nobody seems to be talking about that. Is that a system that's workable as a transition from the current system to a Medicare for All system?
Oh, okay. Deficits are definitely not something that keeps me up at night. You can conceivably have problems, but what we've learned is that advanced countries that borrow in their own currencies have enormous latitude when it comes to debt. And Japan has debt that's more than twice as big. Japan has a debt that's more than twice as big as a share of the economy as ours. And the interest payments on that debt are actually currently negative. So it's no burden at all. And that's, by the way, that's increasingly mainstream. If you look at what people who are actually impeccable, not especially partisan economists, are saying, they're all now saying, boy, this whole debt obsession is really wrong. Now Medicare, there's a long story here, but there is a lot to be said for actually having some form of managed care, not just fee for service, not just present a bill. And what Medicare Advantage done right does is it allows you to fold in some form of managed care while continuing to have the bulk of the financing come from the tax system, and that's fine. There has been some abuse of Medicare Advantage plans, and they have been excessively subsidized. But I think in the end, it would be foolish to try to force everything back into a fee-for-service, because there is some, at least they're done right, there is some value added. And I'm probably biased, because actually it turns out that at the moment, I'm 66, and I have my health insurance through the New York Times, nothing changed from my point of view, except that a good part of the funding started to come from Medicare when I turned 65. So I am, in fact, under a Medicare Advantage plan. So personally, I like it. Although I have to say, anyone who imagines that as opposed to socialized medicine, the U.S. system has no delays in waiting for treatment. Has never been sick in their life.
So let's thank Paul Krugman, a national asset. Thank you very much. That was fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.